I'm sure you have many questions, and some of you would disagree, and I'm wide open, and anything you want to ask. I don't think we need a microphone in here, do we? It's a pretty small room, so just fire away. Yeah.
You say infants can't be regenerated. Can you just say what you mean by infants? Does Scripture give us any indication at what point we could say a child is now able to be regenerated?
Yeah. Well, I don't know when the exact age is. You know, I'm not trying to set up definite line, but I understand Scripture to teach that faith comes from hearing, and hence it would have to be at an age where someone could hear and understand the gospel. The gospel, in my understanding, can be grasped by a young person, even by people who are mentally debilitated to some degree, right? So I think you can be young. I think it differs from child to child. So, but there has to be cognitive capacities. That's all I'm saying, to understand things. And I don't think infants can do that. I think that changes from person to person. You know, when that age is. So I don't think regeneration comes apart from hearing the gospel and believing it. Yeah. Yes. Well, of course, that's a question that comes up very, very often. Some people have written. I was just talking about this with Dan before. So, you know, people have written books like Ron Nash about what happens when a baby dies, and he argues that infants who die before they can hear the gospel are saved. I heard when I was in John Piper's church, I heard him give a sermon based on Romans 1. That the sin of Adam is not accounted if someone doesn't act on that original sin that they've received in Adam. But honestly, my answer is I don't know. I don't have a strong position on that. I am very, you know, that's a very emotional issue. I mean, even here, people may have lost children, so that's just very, very hard. But my response is, will not the judge of all the earth do right? And that, we're all just wired differently. I receive great comfort from that. There will be no one in hell who ought not to be there. God is just, God is loving. And for me, that's the only word I need to hear. Now, maybe these arguments made by people like Nash and Piper and others, at our own school, Al Mohler and Danny Aiken wrote an article arguing for this sort of thing. But it's not crystal clear to me. So, you know, each person has to work that out. But I have just great trust in God. He is a good God. He's just. None of us will meet him on the last day and cavil at, what's that person doing in hell? How could that possibly happen? Well, he's a just God, and loving. Yeah.
You talked about how the old covenant was and so for people in the old covenant, you think were regenerated like Ishmael, and you said the new covenant is for believers. But then you said, but clearly, you know, there are practical issues with that. Sometimes we accidentally baptize someone who isn't in fact regenerated.
Yeah. Well, I don't believe that by receiving baptism that the person receives any covenantal blessing, you know, as some would say, or that he or she is somehow inducted into the covenant. So, you know, 1 Peter 3:21 says baptism is not the removal of dirt from the flesh. So I don't think there's any effective work done in the baptism itself. I do think there's an indication this person has received significant revelation of the truth of the gospel. So we can say there could be a more significant judgment upon this person for experiencing the things of God so significantly. But I don't think there's any indication of some kind of spiritual blessing given through baptism. Do you want to follow up on that? Okay.
Yeah. What do you do with John the Baptist being filled with the Holy Spirit from mother's womb?
Yeah, I think that's an indication that John the Baptist is going to be a prophet, but I think I think we have to beware of pushing verses like that and saying, therefore, I mean, this is something that's very typical in some paedo-baptist circles, especially Lutheran and Catholic, to say from that, therefore we ought to apply baptism and kids are actually regenerate. I mean, if that's the pattern, and I understand the verses there, that can be a difficult verse from someone from a Baptist persuasion, but I would say we just ought not to push a verse like that too far to say that therefore baptism actually regenerates children. You know, if someone believes that is so, then they ought to apply it that way. I want to say then from a Reformed standpoint, then this, that's extraordinarily interesting because the vast majority of those who are regenerated seem to fall away. So the regeneration seems to be quite ineffective. And that's troubling to me. So you know, Luke has this pattern, doesn't he, in Luke Acts of saying the prophets are all filled with the Spirit. So I think that's what he's emphasizing. Yeah, and I'd say if that's the case, I mean, that's a good clarification, so that he's regenerated in the womb apart from baptism, then how do we discern whom to baptize? And we're still faced with the same problem, aren't we? Now, I just think that's an overreading of that text. But now we're faced with an issue where people are being regenerated in the womb apart from the hearing of the gospel. So I guess it's not sacramental baptism, but it's some kind of regeneration apart from hearing the gospel in the womb. And if that's a regular feature of what God does, then again, most of the people who are regenerated in such a way in the womb, or maybe I shouldn't say most, many, some, fall away. And so the regeneration doesn't seem to continue to be effective. And that's problematic in my mind.
One of the criticisms of the Baptist position is that it's too individualistic as opposed to more collectivist mentalities. Now, would you still ever want to talk about God dealing with units of currency that would be a family or a nation? Or do we always have to deal on the individual level of the new covenant? Can you still say that God blesses a nation, blesses a family, curses a nation, curses a family?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think, you know, when we look at I think of our country and England as well, and Western culture, I think there's been a blessing of God on Western culture because it's been significantly Christian, and that has a wonderful effect in a society. And therefore, conversely, there's a judgment of God, I think, that comes on a culture that turns away from the gospel as well. And I think we're experiencing some of that some of that in Western culture. So,
does that mean that there is a better relationship between parents being Christian and us and children being Christian? If it's arbitrary, how can you make those national? Because every generation wouldn't know what was going to happen, but Western culture surely has a tradition of Christianity.
Yeah, well, maybe I'm not answering your question, but it's not arbitrary because God has ordained to bless means. And the means God has ordained to bless is the preaching of His Word. Hence, we think of a country like Tunisia. Well, how many indigenous believers are there in Tunisia? It's a very small number, right? Maybe 100 to 500. I don't know that. That may not be accurate, but it's very small. But parents have great confidence that their children, I don't think a guarantee, but great confidence that their children will belong to the Lord because God has designed it to bless the preaching and proclamation of the word. So I'm not arguing as a Baptist that there's just no connection between parents and children and communities that we live in. I'm simply arguing that the children must be regenerated before they're baptized. But we can have great hope that our children, because of the hearing of the word, will be saved.
How should we treat our children? Is it right to teach my 2-year-old to pray Father?
Yeah. Yes, I've been asked this a number of times, and I think it is right to pray that. I mean, I think there's some ambiguity there, but I don't think that means therefore they're necessarily saved, right? So. I just think there's some ambiguity there. One of my dear friends who became a paedo Baptist, that's exactly the issue he brought to me. You know, he said, "Well, I think my children should call God Father, and therefore they must belong to the people of God." But I think, you know, there's a period of time, isn't there, when someone is drawing near to the Lord and they're calling out to Him, but they don't yet fully belong to Him. But they're still calling out to Him. I think that's happened in the lives of all of us who have become believers. And I think for children, that can be a more extended time.
You're saying about church discipline. I was really helpful. I agree. I think we need to take much more seriously. Generally, in our churches, just interesting, the point you said, something like we need to take seriously our covenant commitments. Just sort of trying to think out how that works. It seems to me that if you're saying the new covenant people are basically the elect, it seems to me that you almost end up with, well, it seems you do end up with an invisible covenant community. And then how does that work out with the church discipline? Because since you don't know who to go as a covenant relationship with, not see.
I'm sorry, I'm not catching exactly what your question is. Yeah. Well, I don't think I have anything new to add. I would simply say that it hasn't been infallibly communicated to us, has it? All of those who belong to the new covenant community. The point that Baptists want to make is that we wouldn't intentionally allow anyone into the covenantal community who is an unbeliever. So, we regard all those who have entered our churches as believers after hopefully interviewing them and determining whether they belong to God. We regard them as believers unless there's a good reason to think otherwise. I think, of course, there's a formative discipline that takes place at a regular level, but if we look at a passage like 1 Corinthians 5 or Matthew 18, there are some significant evidences that warrant excluding someone from a church. But yes, of course, we realize in the already not yet that we likely have people in our communities who are not truly saved. But we don't intentionally allow them in. That's the difference. Yeah. Yeah.
I was going to say, I wonder whether, Tom, when you used the language of you've got to take that covenantal responsibility seriously, I think you were using it in the church covenant sense of the term.
Yes.
New covenant equals church community sense, which is a...
Which might be misleading. Yeah, and I'm thinking of our local church context. So that when members join our church, we have a statement of faith, and we have a church covenant which lays out responsibilities of members. And so we go over that in our membership class, and then when we interview them, we say, "Did you carefully read our statement of faith and our church covenant? Those are the promises we've made to one another as believers. Do you have anything you disagree with in our statement of faith? Are you happy to be taught in accord with our statement of faith and to live in accordance with it, and the same with our church covenant?" And then we say, you know, we trust this will not happen, but we discipline people who fall outside the church covenant. You know, it's just a page. It's really very basic. It's not really strange, weird things on there, you know. Sometimes weird things have ended up there in church history, you know. But it's things like we're going to love one another and we'll faithfully attend and that sort of thing. So, yeah, that's a very helpful clarification. Yes?
Just to follow on from that, you talked about membership retreats and things like that. That's something my church is having. But I was wondering, where is the scriptural warrant for an extended period of catechesis and interview between repenting and believing and baptism? Because it does seem that cases,
yeah, yeah.
The apostles had some particular ability to divine whether someone was in the new covenant that we no longer
have. Yeah, that's a difficult question. That's a good point. I would argue it's legitimate, but good believers would disagree on this. I would argue such a process is legitimate given the complexity and difficulties that have ensued after 2,000 years of church history. In other words, when... In my reading, in the cultural context in which believers first became Christians, it was somewhat analogous to a Muslim becoming a Christian today. It was quite a distinct change from what they were previously. But oftentimes, at least in the United States, people have grown up in a generally Christian culture, and so to join a Church of Jesus Christ, many of them are confused. You know, even on baptism, we have different views. You know, whatever your view of baptism is, even if you disagree with me, presumably we'd all say that our view was the view in the time of the early church, and there wasn't that lack of clarity. But now there is lack of clarity because of the 2,000 years that have followed. So, given that ambiguity, I think it's worth it to do that. I think others could argue, well, that's not a good procedure. We should follow the New Testament more strictly. Understand that. I'd be open to that. Yeah, Charles. No.
Coming back to the question earlier about, you know, do you teach your 2-year-old to pray to God as Father? I want to push a little bit. I didn't hear a theological warrant for, okay, my child is an unbeliever, yet I should in some ways as if they are a believer and are presumably occupying some third space. So,
well, I'm not arguing in prayer that I treat them as if they're a believer. I mean, I don't think it's wrong for unbelievers to call out to God, but I did not communicate to our children that God was their father in the sense that they were saved, you know. And maybe, if I should be pushed a little, maybe you could argue, well, you ought not to call him father. I can't remember now, my kids are older, what words we used exactly. But I don't think it is legitimate to teach children that somehow they belong to the family of God, even in prayer. So,
just on following on from that, in terms of the practice, which is when we baptize them as they get older.
Yeah.
Teenagers were getting up and saying, you know, there was no difference in how we were living then to a year ago in terms of our faith was the same. So there seems to be this issue of baptism as marking when we're believing.
Yeah.
The people who were brought up in Christian faiths.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's like the ultimate thing that was
Well, and my response would be, yes, there's more ambiguity with children, isn't there? It can be harder to discern when someone is a believer. Of course, the same thing can happen to some extent with adults. I mean, some people as adults have very sharp points of conversion, but for some it's a period of time, and then they might look back and think, you know, I've been converted for some time. I mean, that happens with adults as well, but it's more typical for children. And so Baptists struggle with that issue in terms of when to do it. I think in the Southern Baptist Convention, it's been very common to baptize at a very young age, and sometimes I think that's been pretty unfortunate. You know, to baptize so young without really discerning very well whether a person is a believer. Now, someone who's a good friend of mine, and we wrote this in our book, Mark Dever, argues that we ought to delay baptism until you're 18 or so. And he compiles all these accounts of famous Baptists of previous time, and he notes that they were regularly baptized, you know, 12, 16, 20, so they tended to delay more. I appreciate Mark's concern. I mean, Mark's concern is, as Baptists, since we believe in maintaining as far as possible, you know, it's not completely possible, a pure church, that someone is truly converted. That's the reason he wants to do that. I myself, I don't want to go that way, in the sense that I think it is still possible that someone could be truly converted at a young age and that we can discern it. You know, not infallibly, so I wouldn't restrict it to 18 plus. But so I think it's person specific. You know, there's all kinds of issues in the life of the church where we use spiritual wisdom and discernment, fallible as we are, and of course that doesn't just relate to baptism. Yeah.
Within a reformed evangelicalism, got any observations as to within this debate between paedobaptists and creedobaptists with the reformed theology, as to where is the debate at the moment? Some debates, the centre of gravity moves on to one particular issue, exegesis, systematics. So, in your experience, are the issues always the same issues all the time, or is there progress, or have the issues shifted between creedo and paedobaptists?
Yeah, well, I think that's interesting. It seems to me, lately, in the last few years, it's just my limited experience, I'm getting more questions than I did when I was younger about calling God Father, sort of the experiential issues. When do you baptize? I mean, the theological issues are there, but I notice in terms of Baptists are pressed, and it's good for us to be pressed at the practical level more than I heard 10 years ago. I mean, obviously, with the federal vision, there's a new readings of the text as well, but in terms of practically how does it work out, I'm hearing new questions, at least for me, that I didn't hear 10 years ago. But I think every community is different. I mean, I've heard since I've been here more questions regarding the federal vision. I mean, you'd expect this, right? More than I'd hear at Southern Seminary. You know, so every community is different. But I take it... Well, yeah, maybe that's not true. But if you were in Lake Duncan's church in Jackson, Mississippi, that'd probably be different questions being asked. So each community is a bit different. So actually, in my experience, it's more kind of at the experiential level that I'm hearing these things. Yeah?
Are paedobaptists so seriously in error that they should be excommunicated from the
I'm sorry, I missed part of that.
Are paedobaptists so seriously in error?
Yeah. Some Baptists think they should be excluded from the Lord's Supper because they're so seriously in error, and I would argue no. I don't share that view, because I and some of my Baptist friends really disagree with me on this, and they say I'm inconsistent, and maybe I am, but my argument would be, it's possible that I'm wrong, and that they, in good conscience, interpret Scripture that way, and they are possibly right, and they are brothers and sisters in the Lord, so they should share the Lord's table with us. But many, yeah, I mean, that's kind of a live issue at Southern, and many of my colleagues would not agree with me on that. So, and they say that I'm inconsistent, so you can say that too if you want to.
Can you make a comment? We've been talking in Puritan the Doctrine of Salvation class with regards to whether it's a legitimate category in terms of talking about people becoming Christians, particularly thinking about the children, to allow, as well as a conversion model of becoming a Christian, a nurture model of becoming a Christian, whereby it's less of a the light was switched on from darkness to light, and I suddenly had a dramatic sense of testimony, but more a sense of nurture, and whether there's what you would say about that kind of, whether that's a legitimate.
Well, yeah, I think conversion takes place in a number of different ways. I think it can take place dramatically, but I think it can take place gradually and slowly. So I think Baptists have typically said that. I don't have any problem with that. So we ought not to apply baptism until it's clear that someone is converted. And in some cases, it is a gradual process. And we ought not to demand that everybody be converted in the same dramatic way. Not everyone is converted in the way Saul of Tarsus was. So, yeah, I don't have any problem with that. Yeah. Charles, go ahead.
Coming back to another experiential question, would you countenance baby dedication?
What we do at our church is we really don't do them. But, you know, here we're probably pretty inconsistent here again. But if the parents really want to do it, we do it. But it's sort of we've cultivated a culture where we haven't had one for 3 or 4 years, because most of us think it's not ideal, because it's really a parent dedication, you know. And so we tend to discourage it, but I don't think it's wrong necessarily. I just think it's not helpful. So I suppose, I mean, I think most of us, you know, I'm speaking as a Baptist, but those of us who are Baptists, we don't believe in confirmation, and baby dedication can kind of become our kind of, it's not a confirmation, but you know what I'm saying, kind of an extra biblical sacramental thing we do. Yeah.
I come from a Baptist background.
Praise God.
But recently I've been coming across Peter Baptist arguments, which I'm trying to work through. Uh-huh. And one of the things I noticed about some of your arguments, a lot of them seem to be based on an assumption that infants can't have faith.
Yeah.
And Peter Baptist would say that they can. That's why I asked the question about John the Baptist. And also in Psalm 22, talks about God taking him from the womb and entrusting at his mother's breasts. So that language of trust, even whilst being very small. What would you have to say?
Yeah, I would say something I said earlier. I don't think we can push a text like that to say that that infants have faith. I mean, you know, in a poetic psalmic text like that, to read out of that from one's mother's womb one has personal faith, I think is pushing that text farther than we ought to go. What concerns me about it, I mean, I realize some read the text in such a way, but now we have a situation, don't we, where I think faith is coming apart from hearing. That is, hearing and believing and understanding. I suppose one can say, well, they do believe and understand, but how could we possibly discern that? Well, we just baptize them in faith, I suppose, that they have exercised such trust. So I just think that's pushing a text like that further than we should push it.
So how would you understand that trust?
I think he's simply saying that in a vague sense that he belonged to God from a young age. But I don't think we ought to push it to say he had personal faith from a young age. Yeah. So what does that verse say? Let's see. You want to read that for us?
Well, verse 38 says, "And they shall be my people, and I will be their God. I'll give them one heart and one way, that they may fear me forever, for their own good and the good of their children after them." And the sort of good language echoing Deuteronomy's covenantal blessings.
Yeah. I just don't think we could read that as saying that therefore all the children should be given the covenantal sign in the new covenant, because if it is saying that, I think that'd be a great problem for the paedo-baptists, because now we're saying that God will put his law in their heart, but clearly we don't see that happening with many who receive infant baptism. What is the new covenant is a supernatural, unilateral work of God in which he puts the law in their hearts and then it's revoked. So I don't think we ought to read the children there as meaning all the children of covenantal parents, if you want to put it that way, without exception. I don't see how that could follow.
They just seem to be retaining the family structure that you find in the Abrahamic covenant.
Yeah. I think there is a promise. You know, there is a promise to the children. There's a promise that the word will be effective. But to read it as defending infant baptism, I think, is just exceeding the evidence of the text. And in terms of the new covenant as a whole, where's the effectiveness of it then? In other words, I understand the promise of Jeremiah 31 to be a unilateral, sovereign, gracious work of God that is always effective. The new covenant promise isn't, I'll put the law in your heart and then you'll fall away. I think that's just a dramatic misreading of the new covenant. So I think we ought not to press the language of that to say, whoa, the children, all the children should be baptized. It's the children in whom that new covenant work takes place. And of course it's many, isn't it? But it's not all. And I don't think it's a justification of infant baptism. Yeah, well, maybe you haven't asked a question yet, so, or have you?
Yeah, I have.
Oh, okay.
So I'm afraid to ask a question, but it's just a clarification. Should Baptists recognize Peter baptism in terms of if someone who's been baptized and came to the church and then was first faith, the church required to be baptized? I'm asking just because I'm really keen that baptism has become.
And you know, I was 11 years in John Piper's church, and John is a dear friend of mine and has had a tremendous influence on me. And maybe some of you know that that's John's position now, that as a Baptist, he thinks that we ought to allow in a membership in Baptist churches those who have been baptized as infants. I understand why he would hold that view, but I don't agree with it because these are difficult issues, aren't they? But I think there's value as a Baptist of preserving what we would consider to be the fullness of the biblical witness, And I think that's preserved in a church that continues to practice believers' baptism. So, for example, what John wants to do is allow paedo-baptists to be members but not be elders in the church and not have teaching positions in the church. Well, I think that creates a kind of two-tiered membership that's not helpful. In other words, you sort of have second-class citizens in the church. So, it seems to me that you know, please God that we'd all be united together as one Church of Jesus Christ structurally and formally. But I don't think that's going to happen. And I think in our fallen world, there's something worth preserving, even though we thank God for Paedo Baptist evangelical churches. There's something worth preserving in having the distinctive Baptist witness.
So if a child is baptized and in their, in your view, doesn't at that point have faith, they then grow up and they come to faith, they should be rebaptized.
They should be baptized.
They should be baptized. But surely, because you conceded that there are adults who, you know, unintentionally, from your point of view, get baptized when they're in fact not regenerate. So an adult comes to the church, is regenerate, is baptized, and then subsequently comes to faith. Maybe they fall away, show clear signs that they weren't regenerate, but then they come back again. And, you know, now you think, well, okay, this time they really are regenerate. Surely for consistency, you should baptize them also, in quotes, again, close quotes.
Well, yeah, we don't argue it's again. We do baptize them. I've done that a number of times. That's, you know, others may disagree with that, but we would say what happened the first time was not Christian baptism. Yeah. So that'd be a difference, wouldn't it, between some from a more covenantal persuasion and our persuasion. So I've done that very thing. You know, when we interview people, I face this pastorally, and they'll say, you know, I'm not sure sometimes if I was a believer when I was baptized. What we say to people, and this is, you know, it's just a wisdom issue, but we say in our church, we say, if you think you were probably a believer when you were baptized, we don't want to casually and lightly baptize people. So if you think you're probably a believer, we're going to just leave it alone. But some, you know, I can't read people's hearts. And some come back very troubled, and they think, and they're of Baptist persuasion, and they say, I really think I wasn't born again when I was baptized. And we say, well, then we don't think that was Christian baptism, and we baptize them. We don't call that baptism again, you know. So, yeah.
My wife was baptized a few years ago as a believer, but by sprinkling, because that's what was practiced in that church.
Yeah.
Do you think it matters about immersion or sprinkling, and do you think it still counts as baptism if it's by...
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think the fundamental issue is believer's baptism. You know, I do think the pattern in the New Testament is by immersion, but the mode is not as significant to me. I do think the mode in the New Testament was immersion, but believer's baptism is the fundamental issue in my mind. Yeah.
Sorry to press you on another.
No, fine.
Bible text, but
yeah.
So far the ones we've looked at, John the Baptist.
Yeah.
Psalm 22.
Yeah. Well, I don't think Psalm 139 talks about belief in the womb. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
The difference between those and 2 Samuel 12 is that David knows, he's emphatic about the destination of his offspring with Bathsheba. So there is a noticeable difference between those types of texts. So you said before there's no evidence, that's fair enough, you know, that could imply that this person.
Mm-hmm.
And this text is different because David is looking back on somebody else and saying, I know that this guy...
Well, that's probably a good qualification. I should say no convincing evidence. Right? So, well. I mean, the 2 Samuel 12 text, I don't think that's a very clear text. I mean, David says, what does he say? Something like... I'll go to him, right? Well, I mean, many Old Testament scholars would say that's not speaking necessarily of a future eschatological hope, which, at least in my judgment, I think it's there in the Old Testament, but not as clear in the New. I mean, he could be talking about going to Sheol. He could be talking about death. But let's just grant your point for the sake of argument. Let's grant your point that... that this child is spared by God's mercy. Well, of course, many Baptists would think that as well. That doesn't necessarily mean that the sign of baptism ought to be applied in any case. So you know, at two levels. The first level is, what's that text really saying? I don't think it's not terribly clear. It could be just talking about going to Sheol. But even if it is talking about some future happy reunion in God's presence, well, many Baptists throughout history have believed that children can be ultimately saved without being baptized. So I don't think on either score it would necessarily hurt the Baptist cause.
Yeah, I can understand that. It's just that if you're speaking about the issue of infinite salvation, drawing that as a separate issue, there does seem to be something to imply in contrasting David's offspring to Bathsheba and Absalom, the way his grieving is different, that there's something significantly different in that narrative.
Yeah, I just don't know how much to make of that. I mean, Absalom's death is so profoundly different. I mean, he's rebelled against his father, and there's all kinds of unique elements in that story. So, I mean, how much are we going to make of that statement that David makes? You're investing a lot of confidence in that statement, and I'm just not persuaded that we can go there. I believe in limited atonement.
The New Covenant promise in Hebrews 8, verse 11, I've heard it said that and each one of us saying, know the Lord, for they shall all know me from the greatest and the least of the greatest. I've heard it said that knowing the Lord, that all know me, is all about everyone.
I don't think that has any warrant in the text. I see no evidence in the Old Testament that those who knew the Lord were the priests. In fact, they were just as culpable and led astray as the people. In fact, they're particularly indicted. So I don't see any exegetical warrant in Jeremiah, for example, to think that he's thinking of a priestly order over against the people. So I would argue instead, the very point of what Jeremiah is saying is what's happened to the nation. What's happened to the nation is, of course, there's always been a remnant. So is Jeremiah only saying what we've always seen? There's always been a remnant. No, Jeremiah is saying the whole covenant community will know the Lord. That's the uniqueness of the new covenant over against the old. So now everybody who belongs to the new covenant community is regenerate.
And I'll just back as well. I think it's Pratt who argues that his inaugurated continuing events.
Yeah.
I
think he just puts the inaugurated eschatology at the wrong place. I mean, certainly, can I say this, we all believe in already not yet nowadays, and I think rightly so, and that's helpful, but I don't think the already not yet is that some who have the Spirit can lose the Spirit. I mean, I think that Pratt inserts that idea into the text here. Now, what the New Testament teaches is that those who have the Spirit, it's the arabone, it's the down payment, it's the guarantee of the final inheritance. So what is the not yet? The not yet is the fullness of our redemption, which is guaranteed to us. Should we stop here? Do you think? I see Paul wanting to.
We worked on really hard yesterday, and tonight, so very grateful to you.